You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Before I get to the first segment on today's show, a reminder that we are in the middle of a fun drive here at WNYC, actually the second day, and wouldn't you know, it's really snowing. A lot of people stay home from work, but we are expected to be here no matter what. WNYC is available to you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we are so pleased that our guests are all showing up as well, despite the terrible weather. We are asking you to become a member now at 1-888-376-9692 or pledge online at WNYC.org. And remember that for a $120 membership, you can get a 12-month subscription to The New Yorker as our thank you to you for becoming a member. If you're already a subscriber, I'm having a hard time reading this. I'm so excited. If you're already a subscriber to The New Yorker, we will just add 12 months to your subscription. So call now, 1-888-376-9692, a pledge online at WNYC.org. Alexi K. Campbell's play The Pride examines the ways in which the lives of gay men have changed in the last 5 decades. It was originally produced in London, where it won an Olivier Award last year, and now it has been brought to this country by the MCC Theater at the Lucille Lortel Theater on Christopher Street. It's directed by Joe Mantello, and reviewers have called it a thrilling high wire act with some of the season's best acting from a superb young British cast. I'm very pleased to welcome the play's 3 stars, Hugh Dancy, Andrea Riseborough, and Ben Wishaw, to our show today. Hi.
Hi there.
Hello.
Andrea, you've done a lot of theater in London and played Margaret Thatcher in a TV film about her early career. Is this your first your time on New York stage?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
So why haven't you been here before?
I'm not sure. I've just this was just the perfect thing to come over for because I was so enamored with the play.
And Ben, people have seen you in a lot of films here. You played Hamlet. You played a trio of troubled artists, John Keats, right? In Bright Star, Bob Dylan in I'm Not There, Keith Richards in Stone, also a murderer in Perfume.
Yes.
But New York Theater?
This is the first time. Yeah, never had the opportunity before.
Is that because of the rules, the various union rules, or is it just because of circumstances?
It's just I think it's just not come my way before now. That's my understanding.
Well, you were here before, weren't you, on Broadway in 2007 in Journey's End?
That's right, 3 years ago. Yeah.
And listeners are likely to have seen you in films like Adam, Confessions of a Shopaholic, the Jane Austen Book Club, Evening. So you've even spent a fair amount of time working in America.
That's right, yeah.
What appealed to you about this play?
Just the quality of the writing, straightforwardly. I first read it last June, I think, or May or June, when I suppose the MCC were thinking about bringing it over and they wanted to put together a reading, and so I got the play in the post. Hadn't seen it in London. None of us had seen it in London. And
at the Royal Court.
At the Royal Court, yeah. So sat down and read it, and again, kind of casually, because there was no sense that it was going to go any further. But I was gripped by it immediately.
Does the Royal Court now present plays for more than a month? Because I worked there many years ago, actually moving sets and flies.
Really?
And they used to, they would produce a play for a month, and then if it was a success, it would move on to the West End.
Runs. Short runs.
About 6 weeks, huh?
Yeah.
And then sometimes there's an extension.
Yeah. But it won a lot of awards, didn't it?
It did. It won the Olivier Award, as you said, and then it won the Whiting Award for, I guess, best new play of last year.
Did Alexi K. Campbell, the playwright, come over here for the rehearsals?
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yeah, he was here right through the rehearsal period and then through the preview period as well. And
yeah, it was wonderful.
Does it change at all when it is transferred from London to New York?
Well, we weren't in the London production, so actually all of its awards and everything had nothing to do with us, really, did it, unfortunately?
Absolutely nothing to do with us.
It changed, not so much, I think,
but you
specifically because of the move from England to America. It wasn't changed for an American audience, or at least not for that reason. But in rehearsal, I suppose, and with a different dynamic, in little ways, perhaps, you know, Alexei coming back to it after a year had second thoughts, but by and large it's the same play.
Well, it's set in the London of the late 1950s and today. Do you think it could be translated to an American setting the way God of Carnage, which was originally set in Paris, eventually wound up in Cobble Hill in Brooklyn for the Broadway production? Because this is really about the way people, the way, I guess, gay life has changed over the past half century or so.
I think.
Go on.
I think from London to New York, it would translate very well. Mm-hmm. Perhaps from London to Middle America, it might not, or from London to Warsaw, it might not. But you know, there are certain places that would present the perfect context, socially, politically,
the only
geographically.
Problem is, I suppose that, I mean, God of Carnage was already translated, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So you could kind of translate
it. Was really
it
set in France.
That's right. Whereas this play, you know, its original writing is very, very particularly set in London and set in, or at least Britain, and really London of the 1950s, and particularly that part of the play. The language is so precise and so particular. I think to rewrite it for 1950s New York would be like retranslating it.
You certainly
couldn't do the same play with an American accent. It would be kind of an act of surrealism, really.
Well, we also have to keep in mind that in 1958, being homosexual was illegal in England, even though I guess most authorities looked the other way. Attitudes were changing. So this is also about a cusp time.
Yeah, there'd been a report, the Wolfenden Report in Britain, which was a kind of government created investigation into female prostitution and male homosexuality in 1957 was published. And I mean, actually, their recommendation, although it was a fairly conservative report, their recommendation was that homosexuality should be legalized, which didn't then happen for another 10 years. But at the time, there was... there were kind of very... a lot of cross currents going on. The media, there was almost a witch hunt against male homosexuality in particular. The church were up in arms about the idea of it being legalized, or at least some of them were. And a lot of people accused the police of really targeting it and going out deliberately looking for people, enticing people into being arrested. Entrapment, I suppose, is the word I'm looking for. So it was a dangerous time.
My guests are Hugh Dancy, Andrea Riseborough, and Ben Whishaw, who are the stars, in fact, the cast of The Pride, which is now at the Lucille Lortel Theater on Christopher Street, in a limited run?
Till March the 28th.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you don't have
We're missing
time.
A musketeer as well today. Adam James is also
cast. Oh,
right. He's fantastic.
The play, but you play the three main characters, Oliver, Philip, and Sylvia. And we meet them first in 1958 and then in 2008, and the scenes alternate between the two times. Actually, different characters, but with the same names.
Yes.
That's right.
That's correct.
Yeah. To confuse audiences.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I mean, it's quite clear from the start when we switch from 1958 to present times that we are seeing different people and we are in a very different time.
The way I always felt about it was that the two different characters have the same characteristics that transcend through time. So that it's the idea of one person that might blossom in two different time frames. Mm-hmm. Well, that's always the way that I have played Sylvia, understood it. What I think that gives you is that by the time you get to the end of the play, the emotional landscape kind of all makes sense because you've exorcised every part of it.
So are you saying that we're seeing who they would be if they were young adults in 1958 and then if they were the same age?
I think that may be true of some of the characters and not so true of the others. I don't think it's a kind of a rule by which you could watch the play. I mean, I think for Sylvia that's fairly true.
Mm.
She's encouraging, or at least... ultimately kind of falls on the side of examining yourself and you know, is trying to free these two men in a way. But Philip in 2008 and 1958 is a very different kettle of fish altogether.
The character you play.
Yeah, the two guys. And I mean, I don't know about Oliver.
Well, Sylvia, since we were talking about her, had been an actress in 1958.
Yeah.
She's retired from the stage and now is working as a book illustrator. In 2008, she is an actress. So is it easy to find the same character in both?
It's funny. It's odd to kind of articulate it emotionally, even. But internally, the energy that you take from one scene to the next in the two different time frames is very clear. It makes sense. You take the energy from the last scene into the next scene, and it kind of all pieces together. So that you. I mean, my character has two very different accents in the two different time frames.
Do you always sound American in your second character? Or
oh, really? Oh, that's well, interesting. I don't mean that. It's Northern England. Yeah. I mean, it's very, very Northern England. But that's interesting. Yeah, some of the vowel sounds are very similar. Yes, I've kind of...
And that's part of being an actor in England, that you have to think about regional accents all the time? I always thought it was just playing... class accents. It turns out you have to play Northern England, Southern England, Sussex.
Well, Andrea is from the north.
I am from the north. And this is the first time I've ever done my own accent, actually, which is really funny to come to New York and then to do my own accent when I spend lots of time in England doing American one.
Totally lost on us.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you play Philip. Can you tell us about him?
Well, Philip in 1958 is married to Sylvia, has been for a while, and they have, I suppose, superficially at least, a happy marriage. And then Oliver comes into their life because he has been working with Sylvia on this children's book that she's illustrating and he's writing.
But Philip is running a real estate business.
He's running a real estate business.
He really didn't want to do, but it was left to him by his father, and he's
his father. His father died, and then
he's so square.
he's somebody who has. It's funny. It's Sylvia who brings up the fact that maybe he's not so happy in his work. I think he's probably actually quite glad of the trappings, which maybe he kicks against the pricks a little bit. But basically, the fact that he's able to box himself off in his little world, you know, he's got his marriage and his job, and it's he can kind of pay lip service to the frustrations of it, but actually. The one thing he's really scared of is having to take any risks and examine who he really is and what he would really like. And, of course, what he would really like is Oliver. As soon as Oliver arrives, from that point onward, his world is thrown into turmoil because he's forced to... Well, actually, almost manages to resist having to examine who he really is. That's what's going on with him. He can't be honest with himself, let alone anybody else.
He's a photographer in 2008, yeah. Something that perhaps... the other Philip might have wanted to have been if he had been able to take that chance.
That's right. In 2008, he travels. There's, I suppose you could say that if you can imagine a kind of a 1958 Philip as a teenager, somehow that his brother hadn't died, he hadn't been forced to take over the family business, that something had happened in his life to allow him to break out, maybe he would have been that guy.
He talks about emigrating, in fact. And
he does,
although he doesn't
yeah.
say where.
No, he. I think he's rather stung into offering that up when Sylvia provocatively asks him what he would have done if things had turned out differently, and he throws it out as probably a kind of one of those things you say and then wish you could take back, you know. But later on, Oliver throws it back at him, yeah.
And Ben, you play Oliver, the object of Philip's desire, at least in 1958. He's a writer in both eras, but in 1958 he's writing children's books. In 2008 he's a journalist, and very different in both, very closet, not exactly closeted, but kind of closeted in 58, and anything but closeted today.
Absolutely, yeah. But I they're very different characters in the different time zones, but also there is a connection somewhere at the heart of the two of them. But yes, in 1958, Oliver is a children's book writer and closeted because there was really no option but to be closeted. There was no possibility of expressing your love for another man in those days. But he meets Philip one night, and there's an immediate kind of... it's sort of love at first sight. And
And an affair ensues behind Sylvia's back, obviously, between the two men. And then in 2008, Oliver is a kind of jaded, cynical...
promiscuous.
And very, very much promiscuous, lost soul, really. And we first meet him and... I won't give too much away, but we first meet him and his boyfriend's just left him, mm-hmm. which is the sort of catalyst for his self-introspection and self-discovery.
Is this almost like doing something in rep? Because you are, you're really doing two one-act plays, aren't you? But you're going back and forth
within
each act.
It's so very much one play. That even as you're rushing around behind the scenes doing your quick change to reemerge as the other guy or the other woman or whatever it is.
Changing your haircut.
Smoothing your hair down or ruffling it up or whatever it is, you know. Those magical theatrical tricks.
Changing your pants.
Yeah, changing
it. Romantic.
Yeah, yeah. As Andrea said before, the characters may be, I mean, certainly from an actor's point of view, sometimes it's more helpful just to think of them as two separate people. But you also know that there's a through line running through the play, you know. So I personally don't feel that schizophrenic about it.
I wanted to, we'll have to go to a little break. Want to talk a bit more after the break?
Please.
Yeah.
My guests are Ben Whishaw, Andrea Riseborough. Do I say Riseborough?
Riseborough, yeah.
The British way. And Hugh Dancy, and they are the three main characters. The other actor does wonderful, plays many different characters and quite wonderfully. In The Pride, Alexei K. Campbell's play that has been directed by Joe Mantel, a wonderful actor in his own right, and is now at the Lucille Lortel Theater on Christopher Street. Stay with us for more. We're back with three of the stars of the New York production of The Pride, Alexei K. Campbell's play, Hugh Dancy, Andrea Riseborough, and Ben Whishaw. It is at the Lucille Lortel Theater on Christopher Street, and as you pointed out, the cast also includes Adam James, who plays various characters, including a man who is a hired Nazi.
A hired Nazi, yeah.
How else can we say that? He also plays a magazine editor in a moving scene in which he describes visiting an uncle dying of AIDS and asking his mother why he's never met his uncle's friend.
Mm-hmm. Friend of 25 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. We won't go into the hired Nazi part. People's imaginations, I'm sure, are rushing. But some reviews have questioned why that's the only reference to AIDS in the play. Do you think that AIDS has become less of an issue since drugs have turned it into a chronic illness rather than an invariably fatal one?
I think it's obviously become a different issue over the years. Perhaps a broader focus on it. But I don't think any of us have read the reviews, so you can spare us.
You don't read the reviews?
No. But I question whether the implication there, I would say, is that a play with a gay theme, which obviously this one does, is somehow obliged to take on AIDS as an issue, you know, or at least kind of acknowledge it. And I think that this play, that the scope of the play, the ambition of the play, and the questions it attempts to ask, and the themes it addresses are vast, very broad, very ambitious, as I say. I think it does more than enough.
This is really a very important play, I feel, and I feel like that to address that question as well would be another very important play. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
It's kind of trying to meld too many things together at once.
But there was an article in the New York Times this week that talked about how plays about gay men have changed over the years, that they used to be more political, and now they're more likely to be about romance.
Well, it comes down to this phrase, which I keep hearing, was the gay play. Is it a gay play? You know, and at a certain point, I'm not quite sure what that means, and I guess that's what that's the question that you're asking. Does a gay player have obligations to be political, or can it just be a story of, as you say, a romance? Or
it's a play about knowing yourself, isn't it?
This play is a play about identity,
getting to know yourself, and about the oracle that Oliver talks about in the beginning of his story in the first act. And it's very specific that Alexei chose the oracle, because the oracle says, know thyself.
Well, the audience, in the performance I went to, I would guess was only minority gay, because I think that, and I think today, straight people pretty much understand as much about the gay world as gays have always known about the straight world. But in the past, this would not have been the case. There's something like a half a dozen gay theme plays opening this season here in New York. Revivals of The Boys in the Band and La Cage aux Folles, newer plays like Yank, The Temperamentals, Next Fall, and of course The Pride. Are you surprised that all these plays are being lumped together into one category?
I think that it's very strange, because I don't think of it as a gay play or a play about it. It's a play about some people and they're in particular relationships and dealing with particular problems. And it's a play about love. It's really a play about love, which is something that concerns us all.
And the difficulty of the responsibility of really addressing who you are and the play raises the possibility that you can then change that person if you don't like it. That seems to me applicable to literally every single person on earth.
And the responsibility of how you use that love as well.
But there's also another thing about change. Adam James plays a doctor consulted by Philip in an attempt at aversion therapy, and the description of it is quite chilling.
Yeah, it's and it's all gleaned from true accounts of what people went through in the 50s in Britain, and I've no doubt here as well. That in fact, if you were arrested in Britain in you know, for public, whatever it would be, cottaging basically, you were obliged to go for these kind of therapies. And I mean, without giving too much away about the particular scene,
which is one of the saddest in the play.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yes, they felt that medically they could cure you of being gay, with some fairly dramatic methods.
Well, psychotherapists considered homosexuality an illness until maybe 20 years ago or so.
So I'm reading a book at the moment. When I'm in the middle of the show, I have a kind of 20 minute off stage, and I'm reading a book called, somebody called Edmund Bergler, I think Edmund, who was, I guess, a pretty prominent psychotherapist at the time, called Homosexuality, Disease or Way of Life. But he makes it pretty clear in the first paragraph that he comes down with the former.
Are you reading that as research for your character?
I'm reading it because I've got that time. I can't just sit there doing nothing.
You could read your reviews.
I've actually got them pasted inside the book. No, it's because you want to do something, but you don't want to veer completely out of the world. And it's actually fascinating. I mean, it's not something, obviously, that I would have ever found, probably got a hold of, but it's...
I'm curious about the three of you not reading your reviews. I know a lot of actors say that they don't read them. They don't like to read them, even if they're all positive, because if a reviewer says, Andrea Riseborough is particularly effective in the scene where she says this thing, then...
Dead. From then on, it's dead. I think the thing is that it's certainly not that we don't think that we could learn anything, because people who review plays have a huge wealth of experience, having watched years and years and years of theatre. The thing is that you have a very specific and very delicate relationship, precious relationship, with a director, and Joe Mantello's a fantastic director, and also he's the vessel through which anything he feels useful will translate to us. So it's to interrupt that, to have 15 different directors as opposed to just one is an extremely confusing and not very helpful thing. I don't feel myself. I don't know how you guys feel.
I feel absolutely the same as you. Yeah.
Well, I'm curious about Joe Mantello directing, because we've been seeing a lot of plays in New York, of American plays with British directors, and I wonder about whether directing is directing.
I think every director is a different creature, be he or she American or British.
Joe Mantello comes out of David Mamet. I don't know whether you feel that influence.
No, not. I think not at all. I know that he's worked on and with Mamet, but I have not done either, so I can't say for sure. But Joe is a very he likes to drop a suggestion. And then leave it with you. And he does it in such a way, he's eloquent in such a way that, at least my experience was, that suggestion then grows and kind of, you know, gains speed in your mind and takes you off in a different direction. And he's confident enough to give you his thought without necessarily knowing where it will take you, but trusting that you will find something from it. And, I mean, that, for me, is a great trait in a director. But you know, but
some directors don't trust you.
Well, no. But some directors will want to be more precise. And I mean, you know, I suppose it's also about you trusting the director. If you have a director that comes and says, you know, I'm gonna be really specific with you all the way through this play, and I'm gonna be on your back all the way through. Well, if you trust that person, okay, I'm happy to work with you like that. It doesn't mean to say that you want everybody to be working in that way.
Mm. Having been an actor allows you to offer things. And he's supportive when you do, you know.
Right, although that...
Having been a director? Having been an actor?
No, you said having been an actor. Although I think sometimes, I mean, actors who become directors are not very good at giving anything other than quite precise. They're trying to edge you into the performance
that they would have given
or that they can see in their mind, and that's disastrous.
Mm. Phil, you keep on nodding your head, but you're not talking.
I think, no one can see me nod my head. I think that maybe he has taken some things from David Mamet, from what I understand about David Mamet, because I think...
There's a certain amount of talking over each other at the beginning, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And as far as I understand David Mamet's tastes, they're very much about... there's nothing extraneous, so it's just about... it's about sort of shaving away the fat, and I think that Joe's brilliant at that.
That's true.
And keeping the kind
really
of forward
is.
Momentum of the play and treating it almost as a piece of music, which is how he talked about it quite
often. Did I call you Phil? Ben is your name. I have a guest coming on later whose name is Phil, and that's stuck in my head. There are those directors like Alfred Hitchcock who said that all actors are cows, and I don't know whether you ever run into somebody who has so little respect for what you do, but most directors tell me that if you cast correctly, you just trust those people, you know what they can do, and once in a while you can just push them into something that allows them to go a little deeper.
Mm. Mm.
That's a very good summary. Yeah.
The set that we have at the Lucille Hotel has a transparent quality with mirrors and open areas through which we can see the characters enter and exit, and sometimes characters from two different times are on the stage at the same time. Now, you said that you had not seen the production in London.
No.
Do you have any sense? Is that written in the script?
The sense I've got is that there's more of that overlapping in this production from people who have seen it. And again, that's something I think that Joe, although it's in the play, there's a note at the beginning of the play to suggest how it might be staged. But I think Joe really, really saw that from the beginning. And as Ben said, it's almost as kind of conducting this piece of music. It's something that's one thing that I think, obviously, we're kind of in the scenes, but those transitions and the effect that they have on an audience is not something I really think I understand, never having watched it, obviously.
In the past, it was my sense that British actors did a lot more theatre, partly because they loved it, they grew up with it, but also because the British film industry was going through a rough time. And now we're seeing more and more American actors turning to the theater as well. Is that because Hollywood is going through a rough time, or are we seeing a change from the early days where actors began in theater, then went into films, to the time when a lot of actors began in films and then wondered, hey, what's it like to do theater?
There's that there's a line in the new that new play. God, what's it called? I've forgotten, but it's about the two gossip columnists that's on at the moment. By Douglas
Mr. Carter. Mr. and Mrs. Fitch.
Yeah, he says theatre is what movie people do when they want to make it clear that they're available for television. But I don't know. I don't see any particular. I mean, I guess the train swings back and forth, and there was a period, I don't know, I remember 10, 15 years ago in London when suddenly, I guess, celebrity casting was huge, and because a couple of theatres had done it really successfully,
and it's happened on Broadway.
Sure, and it's happened on Broadway, and then suddenly you get, you know, and then you get this year, you were saying, this season, you know, all these plays coming in with gay themes, and everybody says, well, is this a new happening? No, I just think it's people found a bunch of good plays, you know.
It's very addictive, theatre, and it's very immediate, and the thing.
Why? How is it addictive? I'm doing the same thing every night. Actors obviously
love it.
Yeah,
gluttonous punishment. But that's exactly it, you know, that it is addictive in that way, that you always want to, for some strange and unbeknown reason, you want to keep excavating this one thing and getting deeper and deeper inside of it until the feeling is absolutely dynamic and
or
perfect.
You want to please at least get it right once.
Well, I've always wondered whether, from what actors have said to me about this, whether it wouldn't be best to try to see a play about 2 weeks before it closes. Because by that time, they have really thought everything they can have thought about their characters. And then for the last 2 weeks, of course, they're now cruising because it's about to close.
Yeah.
But I don't know about that. I mean, I've done, you know, been in productions that have gone on much longer. And I've never got to the point at which I think, oh, I get this now.
Finding new things.
Yeah, yeah.
It just gets bigger and bigger and bigger the more you do it.
Just gets bigger.
And you're constantly faced. And I mean, it's ridiculous. I should have realized now that. But you can constantly come off stage and have the thought, oh, I get that bit now. Oh, I understand it now. It's got that in it. And then a week later, you'll do it another way, and you'll find something else in it.
And it's immediate because you breathe the line out and the audience literally breathe it in front of you.
You also
sometimes
have other actors.
Blow it back at you.
But you also have other actors that you're interacting with. And so what happens when you get a response from one of the other actors that you've never gotten before?
That's interesting. So thrilling. Wonderful. Yeah. It's the best thing ever.
Usually.
I guess it depends
on
what the response
out of 10,
is.
Yeah.
I've heard that the Pride might transfer to Broadway. Is there any truth in those rumors?
I don't think there's. It's probably not going to transfer after the L'Hôtel, at least not at the moment. But we were. It was extended in the L'Hôtel, as we said, till March the 28th.
Mm-hmm. And then you go back to London.
We do, me and Andy.
Yeah.
Do
you go back?
Well, I go to Boise, Idaho, actually.
Yeah.
You go to Boise, Idaho?
Yeah, I go to Boise,
Why don't we all
Idaho
go to Boise? See
what's happening in Boise?
My partner's from Boise, but we met in LA, but he's from Boise. I'll go back there and then go to,
So that I would assume that all of you can do American accents.
Yes, Mark, but not on radio stations.
Mark Ryland, he, in a brilliant production of Boeing Boeing here, did a Wisconsin accent, and I asked him, how the heck did he get that? And he said, well, I spent a couple of years in Wisconsin when I was a kid. And so now I could spend 10 years in England and not come back with a British accent.
But you know,
this is something that actors
do. There's a reason for that it's harder for an American person to do an English accent than it is for an English person to do an American accent. And that's because the back of the tongue becomes very muscular in America to make the vowel sounds that you have. And so it's hard to kind of deplete that muscle. Whereas in England, we can raise our tongues up to make the same kind of sound that you make.
I can't believe you're giving that away.
I'm not even
We
sure
all know that,
sorry,
that in
guys.
Britain. Everybody in Britain knows that.
For years, British actors did lousy American accents. Laurence Olivier never got the American accent right.
It doesn't
I think
mean
something
has
happened to actors
it.
Today.
It doesn't mean everyone has an ear for it, but just biologically it's slightly easier.
I think actors
Rubbish.
Have changed, don't you? I think
true.
That American
it's
actors, you have something like Renee Zellweger doing a perfect British accent, at least to my
incredible.
Ear.
I think actually one of the side of it is, and I think Andrew's right, actually, it is maybe slightly easier in that a British person can kind of relax their voice in a way. into an American accent. But anyway, the side effect, I think, is that from what I've seen, American actors often work a lot harder at a British accent in a more precise way. And although a lot of British actors do wonderful American accents, I think on stage in London, I see it more kind of sloppy, slightly non-specific American accents than I see the reverse here. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also...
Well, by the way, for the rest of this conversation, you're going to have to speak in American accents.
You can be more specific. Come on, you've got to...
But I don't think it's only about... It's not only about the sounds that you make, is it? It's about, you know, there are other differences between Americans and English people that are also hard to embody.
Inflection.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
well, no, not
and internal things and
like
values and things that change the way people behave and sound and whatever.
Well, you're doing a wonderful job playing Brits, anyway, in Alexei K. Campbell's play The Pride, which is at the Lucia Lortel at 121 Christopher Street in the Village. A great, wonderful theater, big enough and small enough.
Yeah. That's right. It's kind of got a grandeur to it because of its history, but it's
there used to be the Theatre
well.
De Lee, did you know that?
Sorry?
Yeah.
It used to be called the Theatre de Lee.
De Lee.
L-Y-S, yeah. I guess.
Like Fleur de Lis.
Yes, yeah. Right. Mm. But Lucia Lortel is such a wonderful person, so important to American theater, they named the theater after her. I've always thought that they should try to match plays to the person they've named the play, the theater after, but often you get weird comedies at the Eugene O'Neill and it's totally inexplicable.
Right. In this very, case, very earthbound plays at the American Airlines Theater.
Eugene liked a comedy from now and then, I'm sure.
Thank you all so much for being with us. Hugh Dancy, Andrea Riseborough, Ben Wishaw, three of the stars of The Pride.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.